Colossians chapter 4. Colossians 4 is where we're going to spend our time in this Bible class period this morning. And while you're opening your Bible and getting settled, we welcome all of you. Thank you so much for being here today. I am very happy to be with you. As Scott said, it was a bit of an adventure yesterday. I was feeling a little bit like Gilligan's Island. You know, it was supposed to be a three-hour cruise and going to be stranded on an island somewhere. And so I think 16 and a half hours en route getting here yesterday. So that's a long time. I almost could drive from Florida in that amount of time, I think. So it's so good to be with you all again. I remember very, very fondly the last two times that we've been together, and glad to get to study the Bible with you again, and glad to get to talk with you again about some matters that have to do with home and with family. But as was suggested in this Bible class period, we're going to step outside of that box. We'll begin that series in the worship hour this morning. But I want to talk a little bit this morning, if I may, just a few things that have to do with evangelism for the rest of us. I hope you'll follow along with me with this. I think this is extremely important. I've been trying to say some things along this line in a variety of places over the last year or so in these Bible class periods. And I want to talk about this in a way, hopefully, that is non-threatening. I think sometimes when preachers mention evangelism, the audience gets nervous. You know, here's another preacher who's going to make us feel guilty that we're not doing enough. We're not talking about the Lord enough. We haven't converted enough people. And he's going to tell us, you know, that we haven't done enough and make us feel guilty about that. And I want to tell you that I'm not into drive-by guiltings. That's not me. But I do want to talk about some things in this period that everybody can do, whether you're 6 or 16 or 68, 18 or 80. It doesn't matter. There are some things that all of us can do in evangelism. And I do want to talk about that this morning. You know, for the past decade and a half, John Grisham has been one of the most popular fiction writers, authors in the world. He has sold somewhere in the vicinity of 300 million volumes. Can you imagine that? He sold 300 million books. His very first book was entitled A Time to Kill. It didn't do very well. It only sold 5,000 copies, which in the literary world really is not very much at all. His second book was entitled The Firm. And The Firm wasn't selling any better than A Time to Kill. But as people began to read The Firm, it really was an interesting book, and it caught their attention. And so they liked the book, and then they began to learn a little bit about Mr. Grisham, and they liked the author of the book, and so they began to tell others. And eventually, The Firm sold 7 million copies. And what was interesting then is the people who liked The Firm and had met Mr. Grisham, at least on television, they went back and began to read A Time to Kill. And it too became a bestseller as well. And it all happened because they liked the book and they liked the author of the book, and so they told others. Does that have any application to us at all in the realm of evangelism? Well, of course it does. Of course it does. But let's take that a step further. Let's imagine that you have a teenager, you have a teenage son. And your son is a very, very gifted writer, and he believes that he could make his life's work as an author. And imagine if John Grisham were to reach out to you and say, you know what, I have read some of your son's writings. I believe that he truly has a great deal of talent. Here's what I'm willing to do. I'm willing to come and work with your son, mentor him for a week in the craft so that he can hone his skill as an author. How valuable would that be? Well, it'd be absolutely invaluable, wouldn't it, to have that kind of instruction and that kind of training. Imagine that you have a child in high school, and so this child is a very gifted golfer. And they are not just a duffer, but I mean they are gifted. And so they have a full-ride scholarship, but really they're looking beyond that, and they believe that they're going to be able to make their living on the tour. And imagine that if Rory McIlroy or Jason Day were to reach out to you and say, you know what, I've seen some video of your child playing golf. They have a unique skill, a truly generational skill, and here's what I'm willing to do. I'm willing to come and mentor your child in their golf game to try to help them. How valuable would that be? Well, again, it would be absolutely invaluable to have that kind of mentorship. When it comes to evangelism, ladies and gentlemen, we get to learn from the very best. When God Almighty looked down from heaven and he chose an evangelist to send around the world, a personal worker, to use our vernacular, to impact countless lives, he chose a gentleman named Saul of Tarsus. In fact, that was God's language. He said, "You will be my chosen vessel." And so, if you want to know about evangelism, he's one of the finest examples that we could ever follow. I mean, we could begin in Acts chapter 13, and we could read those following chapters, and there are three missionary journeys there, and there are countless examples of success and failure. And there is much, by the way, to learn from both. And there are those countless illustrations of evangelistic episodes that he had. And so we could learn from all of that. But it seems to me that Paul gives us a synopsis of evangelism in Colossians chapter 4, where I asked you to open a moment ago, in Colossians chapter 4. So I want you to read with me, if you will. Colossians 4, I want you to read with me beginning in verse number 2. And we'll just read three or four verses together. Colossians 4, verse 2. He says, I want you to continue earnestly in prayer, being vigilant in it with thanksgiving. And meanwhile, praying also for us, that God would open to us a door for the word to speak the mystery of Christ, for which I also am in chains, that I might make it manifest as I ought to speak. Walk in wisdom toward those who are outside, redeeming the time. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. Let's stop right there. When I read those verses, it seems to me that Paul takes the experience from years of missionary travels, conversations with thousands and thousands of individuals, and he distills the essence into three imperatives. And what I want you to consider with me this morning is that these three imperatives, Colossians 4, have nothing to do with methods or systems or selling or closing the deal. They don't have anything to do with that. Now, there may be some methodologies and systems that would be helpful, but primarily, it's about one individual introducing another individual to Jesus Christ. So here's what we're going to do in the minutes that we have left. We're going to take half our time and make three applications from Colossians 4. And then we'll take the last half of our time. And I want to talk to you about four things that everybody can do in evangelism. And I think that those together will help us perhaps see this from a little different perspective. So let's begin right here. Here's what Paul says. Number one, I want you to consider your God. In Colossians 4, here's where he says that, beginning in verse 3. He says, meanwhile, praying also for us, that God would open to us a door for the word, to speak the mystery for Christ, for which also I'm in chains, that I might make it manifest as I ought to speak. In other words, Paul says, look, I need your help. That's amazing to me, that the Apostle Paul would say to these people, look, I need you to help me in evangelism. And here's what I need you to do. I need you to pray for me. But it's amazing to me that Paul would say to these, I need you to help me with evangelism. I mean, to me, that would be like LeBron James coming to me and saying, hey, Don, could you show me how to shoot a jump shot? I need some help there. I mean, I think he knows how to do that. It would have been to me like Peyton Manning when he was in his prime saying, hey, Don, could you teach me how to read a defense? Maybe show me how to throw a football. I think he's got that down. And so here's the Apostle Paul. Here is Paul. He is Holy Spirit-filled, brilliant scholar, seasoned veteran, gifted evangelist, church planter, and he says to these Christians, I need you to help me with evangelism. Well, to do what? He said, I need you to pray for me. And specifically, he says, I need you to pray that there will be some doors of opportunity that will be open for me. And we need to pray the same. So I want to ask you this morning, did you pray that prayer, by the way, this morning? Did you ask God this morning to open a door of opportunity for you to say something to someone about Jesus Christ? I think we need to pray that prayer. Pray for the interaction with your neighbor. Pray for the moms, the playgroup. Pray for the guy who works next to you in the cubicle at work, or the teacher in the next room to you at school, or the friend at school or at college. To pray, to open a door of opportunity, to just say something that introduces the subject of God, or faith, or religion, or Jesus. I want you to notice, ladies and gentlemen, that Paul does not say, I want you to pray to God that he will open a door for me to speak to 85,600 people at Levi Stadium in San Francisco on Super Bowl Sunday. He doesn't say that. You know why? Because that's not going to happen. But he does say, I want you to pray for what can happen, for the interactions with a neighbor or a friend or a coworker, because those interactions can happen, and they do happen. And specifically said, I want you to pray that I will have wisdom so that I might know what to say. That's what he said. I need you to pray that I will know what I should say. I think we've all been in that circumstance, haven't we? I mean, if you've been a Christian very long, then we've probably all had the situation where we've been in a circumstance where we know an opportunity is being presented to us, and we know that we should say something. We just don't really know what to say? So let me tell you what to say. When you know that door of opportunity is being opened to you to say something about your faith, talk about your faith. Talk about your life. See, that's usually not where we want to start. We always want to start with, let me give you my 10 reasons why baptism is essential to salvation. Let me give you my 5 reasons why we don't use an instrument of music in worship. Let me give you my 12 reasons why Calvinism is not according to Christ. That's not where people want to begin. People want to begin by knowing, what does Christianity mean to you? You can't argue with that. That's something that is real to individuals, that has credibility with people. It makes a difference with people. I live in Temple Terrace, Florida, which is a suburb of Tampa. I've lived there for January 1st will be 25 years now. And from the first week that I was there, I've gone to the same dry cleaner. It was recommended to me by one of our members. And when I first started going to it, the owner was kind of the patriarch of a family. And he was a gruff old guy. He was a crusty old guy. But I always got along well with him. He was always kind to me. But he was just gruff. He was gruff. Well, he passed away. And his son inherited the business. And his son is the polar opposite of his dad. His son loves everybody. He's friendly. He's outgoing. He's gregarious. He likes everybody. His name is Mark. And so I've always gotten along wonderfully well with Mark. But I went in one day. This was about 5 or 6 years ago. I went in one day, and something clearly was wrong. And I said, Mark, what's bothering you today? Clearly, something's not right. And he said, well, Don, he said, it's my wife. He said, she's been diagnosed with breast cancer. And he said, Don, it's really serious. And I said, well, Mark, I'm very sorry for that. I said, no, my wife has never had cancer. I said, but I'll tell you, my mom and dad had cancer. And I said, Mark, what got me through that was faith and prayer. And I said, you know so many of the members at the church where I work because we use your business. I said, if it's all right with you, I'm going to ask them to pray for your wife. I said, what's your wife's name? He said, Valinda. And I said, we're going to pray for Valinda. We're going to pray for her healing. So as I would go in, I didn't ask him about Valinda every time I went in, but I would ask him on a regular basis. One day I went in, I said, Mark, how's Valinda? He said, Don, she's been told that she's cured, that she's cancer-free. And I said, oh, Mark, thank God for that. We are so, so thankful for that. I said, we've been praying for that. So about 2 weeks later, in between Bible class and worship at Temple Terrace, there's a little lady in our foyer that I don't recognize. She's a little tiny, diminutive lady. And I go up to her and I stick out my hand. I said, I'm Don Truex. I said, welcome. We're glad you're with us. She said, well, I'm Valinda Kornheiser. I said, are you Mark's Valinda? She said, yes, I am. Well, another one of our families was standing by, and they heard that, and they knew who she was, and so they kind of took Valinda under their wing, took her in, sat with her. They began to study the Bible with her. And lo and behold, it was only about a month later that Valinda was baptized. She's a very faithful Christian to this day. Now, Mark, that was a little different story with Mark. Mark is Jewish. Nobody in his family has ever left Judaism, ever. And so when they would study with Valinda, if they were at her house, Mark wouldn't come in where they were studying, but the people studying with Valinda, this couple I was telling you about, they told me they knew that Mark was listening in the other room. And then it got to where Mark would listen in the other room and he would send questions for Valinda to answer. And then Mark started coming to worship on Sunday morning. And wouldn't you know it, it was just about the time that I had some things to say about how we know Jesus is the Messiah, the fulfillment of Jewish promise. And about 6 months after that, Mark was baptized. And they're both faithful Christians. And it just began because we just found a way to introduce the subject of faith and something that's meaningful and real to us in a way that had credibility with someone else. We need to pray for those opportunities, and we need to pray, ladies and gentlemen, for wisdom to know what to say. And we need to pray for God's help. Paul said, who's Paul and who's Apollos? We're just ministers through whom you believe. But as the Lord gave to each one, he said, I planted and Apollos may have watered, but it's God who gives the increase. We all have different roles. Some are just wonderful teachers, and some are very good at broaching the subject with others. I planted Apollos watered. But God gives increase. God knows which hearts are open and available. He knows which hearts are hard as stone, even though the person might be the nicest person in the world. God knows. And so we need to pray for God's wisdom in dealing with that person. And when somebody's obedient, we need to give God the credit. Give God the glory for that. You and I didn't die for anyone. And so we need to consider your God. Secondly, we need to consider our connections. And Paul said that right here. Walk in wisdom toward those who are on the outside, redeeming the time. Now, there's a word in that verse that's extraordinarily important, ladies and gentlemen. It's the word outside. Paul says, I want you to walk in wisdom toward those who are on the outside. Now, that's not very politically correct. We live in an all-inclusive, everybody gets a trophy in a snow cone kind of world. Everybody's okay. I'm okay. You're okay. We're all okay. God loves us anyway. But Paul says, look, some are on the outside. God has divided this world into saved and lost. That's hard for us sometimes to realize, isn't it? See, part of our problem is that neighbor who is so friendly, that coworker who is so helpful, that fellow student who is so brilliant, that family member that is so loved, we forget, ladies and gentlemen, that if they've not been obedient to Jesus Christ, they are, what's the Bible word? Lost. It's hard for us to think in those terms about individuals. So what are we supposed to do about that? Well, obviously, we need to make sure that we're building some relationship there. Walk in wisdom toward those who are on the outside. So we redeem the time. We got to build a relationship. Paul, by the way, Paul assumes that we're going to have a relationship with non-Christians. Did you notice that? Walk in wisdom toward those who are on the outside. The assumption is that we're going to have relationships with people who are on the outside of Christ. I think sometimes Paul had no illusion that when we became a Christian, we were going to isolate ourselves in a Christian cocoon somewhere. I think sometimes we think that would be great. If I could just wake up in a gated Christian community and get in my car and go to a job where only Christians work, and on my way home stop at a grocery store owned by Christians and operate, and then go back to my gated Christian community and just close the door, that would be a great way to live. And Paul says, no, not at all. Not at all. He assumes that we're going to share life with those who don't know God. It's what Jesus assumed. You're the salt of the earth. You're the light of the world. It's what Paul assumed. Philippians chapter 2. You've got, in this crooked and perverse generation, among whom, in that generation, you've got to shine like lights in the world. And so Paul just assumes that we will purposefully, intentionally relate to people and make an effort to introduce them to Jesus. And so we've got to build relationships. And we've got to walk through some open doors. When doors are open, we've got to walk through open doors. Do you remember what Paul said on one occasion? He said, I become all things to all men. I become all things to all men. That does not mean, don't misunderstand the apostle here. That does not mean that he was going to sacrifice his values or his morals or his character. Neither should we. But it does mean that we're going to try to be positively involved in individuals' lives. That's exactly what Jesus did. You remember one of the indictments that evidently was repeatedly made against Jesus? He eats with tax collectors and sinners. And what did Jesus say? He said, well, I plead guilty to that. Guilty is charged. Why would you do that? You ever think about the fact that Jesus spent a lot of time with the kind of people that make us very uncomfortable? It made his co-religious Jews extremely uncomfortable. He eats with tax collectors and sinners. And Jesus said, yes, guilty is charged, because those who are well don't need a doctor. Those who are sick, these people are spiritually sick. They need to be introduced to God. They need the great physician in their life. And so I'm going to spend some time with them. Those are intentional relationships. And so we need to consider our connections. And then third, out of Colossians 4, we need to consider our words. I like the way Paul phrased this. Have you ever thought about what he says here? In this context, he says, let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. So in this context of, I need you to pray for me that old doors will be opened, I'll know what to say, so that we can impact individuals who are on the outside with the gospel of Jesus Christ. In that context, he says, we've got to be careful with our words, because what we say and how we say it will speak volumes to others about who we are. Let me say that again. What we say and how we say it will speak volumes to others about who we are. If you don't believe that, just read Matthew 26. And here's the Apostle Peter, and he's warming his hands at the enemy's fire. And there's a young maiden girl who says, hey, you were with the Galilean. And he says, no, you got me confused with somebody else. He said, no, I don't think so. Your speech gives you away. That Galilean drawl that you have gives you away. What gives us away? Now, sometimes what gives us away is our accent. We can tell where we are from the United States, but that's not the point of that. The point of it is that how we say what we say, especially to those who are on the outside, speaks a lot about us. We sing this song, Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Sound. And we need to make sure that we're saying that to people. The Bible says a lot about sin and about judgment. There's no denying that. We should never try to smooth the edges off what the Bible says about sin and judgment. But we've also got to let people know that God's grace can forgive them. And that God can make them into something better than they are now. And that there is nobody, no matter how far, fast, or hard they have run from God, but can't come home to Him. And we need to make sure that according to Colossians 4 and verse 6, we know how we ought to answer each one. Have you ever thought about that? Because it's saying that individuals are just that. They're individuals. We need to know how to answer each one. See, I think we've almost been programmed to believe that if we could just get in evangelism, if we could just get the right open and the right clothes to seal the deal, we could baptize the world. But the problem is that people aren't one size fits all. It doesn't work that way. The gospel is the same, but people are different. And so we got to know how to answer each one. Some individuals are extremely analytical. They want everything laid out in logical, sequential order. They want everything to go from point A to B to C to D. They want them to be able to draw what is for them a logical conclusion. Some individuals are at the other end of that spectrum, and they're emotional. And you tell them the story of the cross, of God dying for them, and it will profoundly impact them. Some individuals are skeptical, as we said a moment ago. And so what they want to know first is, what does Christianity mean to you? You're asking me to change my life. All right, fair enough. But first, how's it changed your life? Does it make you happy? Does it make you sad? Does it make you a better mom, a better dad? Does it make you a better person? What's Christianity done for you? You're asking me to change my life. What's it done for you? And so we've got to know how to answer each one. And so, in Colossians 4, Paul says, look, consider your God, asking for help. Consider your connections. We've got to have relationships with those on the outside if we ever hope to bring them on the inside. And third, consider your words, because the words we speak will make a profound difference. Now, what I'd like to do in the minutes we have left is segue away from that, if I may. And I want to talk about some things that everybody can do in evangelism. And what I want to talk about, basically, are four things that everybody can do. And again, it doesn't matter if you're 8 or 18 or 80. Now, you're probably going to recognize these because my friend Max Dawson was with you last year, and I think he shared these with you. Max came to where we are at Temple Terrace, and he shared these four things, and he did it very quickly. We've taken these four, and we have elaborated on them a lot. We have made them into bookmarks. We keep them in front of our people. We put them in our family report, our bulletin. I talk about them at least a couple of times a year from the pulpit, and I want to elaborate on them with you this morning. Because these four things are something that every single person can do in evangelism. So with a nod to my friend Max, I want to elaborate a little bit on these concepts and maybe personalize them for you. So here's four things that everybody can do. Everybody can shine. Everybody can shine. I know Jesus said we could do that. Let your light so shine before men that it may see your good works and thereby glorify your Father who's in heaven. What's he saying in that? He's saying that wherever you are, wherever you may find yourself, live in such a way that the gospel is enhanced and never diminished. You know, that's a common theme in the Bible. For example, in Titus chapter 2, Paul wrote to his young protege Titus, and he said, Titus, I want you to say some things to aged men and aged women and young men and young women. Now, there were some distinct things for each of them, but there were also some very common things. And so, in Titus 2, and beginning in verse 3, he said, Titus, tell them that they need to live in such a way that nobody will be able to look at their life, and here was his phrase, malign the gospel. Make sure you live in such a way that nobody can look at your life and malign the gospel. In Titus 2, verses 6, 7, and 8, he said, you live in such a way that those who may be opposed will be ashamed, having nothing evil to say of you. That is, somebody wants to be an enemy of the cross. If they're looking at your life, trying to find some chink in the armor, something that they can hammer away out as an inconsistency, he said, don't let them find that in you. Colossians 1, or Philippians 1, verse 27. Conduct yourself worthy of the gospel. Colossians 4, that we just read a moment ago, verses 5 and 6. Walk worthy. What's he saying in all that? He's saying that you've got to make sure that you show by your life that Christianity makes a real, practical difference in your life, in your family, in the way that you work on the job, if you're a boss, in the way that you lead your employees, in your friendships, that this has made a practical difference in your life. That's what Jesus said we do. Let your light so shine that others may see your good works and thereby glorify your Father who's in heaven. That's pretty easy. Everybody's on board with that. Nobody's going to argue with that. We need to live a life worthy of the gospel. Where it gets challenging, I think, is in the second word, and that is speak. And everybody, I think, can speak. Now, I realize when I say that, that I think immediately some individuals say, well, Don, there's some speaking I can't do. I could never stand in a pulpit and preach. That's all right. Not everybody has to do that. I could never stand in front of a Bible class and teach a Bible class. You know what? That's okay, too. You don't have to do that. When I was growing up in our fellowship in Churches of Christ, I was basically taught that every Christian should be a Swiss Army knife Christian. You should be able to do everything. You should be able to do everything. And so when it comes to evangelism, you should be able to make an overture to somebody, introduce the subject, set up the class, teach the class, baptize them, and then you should be able to disciple them to the point that they then are able to disciple others. And what we do with that is that we oftentimes take square pegs and try to make them fit in round holes. You know, we got plenty of people who can do all those things. You don't have to do everything. But everybody can speak to some degree. Now, you may not be able to preach. You may not be able to teach a Bible class. That's all right. But everybody can learn to speak to some degree. Jesus said that. Therefore, whoever confesses me before men, him will I also confess before my Father who's in heaven. The confession before men, you recognize, you're good Bible students, that in Matthew 10, that confession is not the confession before baptism. If you want that confession, you go to Romans 10. But this confession is on the heels where he says, whoever denies me before men, him will I also deny before my Father who's in heaven. This is the confession of daily life. This is owning Jesus in daily life. And he says, if you'll do that, I will own you. Here's the point, ladies and gentlemen. We need to learn. We need to learn to season our conversation with references to God, and references to Christ, and references to the Bible, references to the church. It's easy. Listen to me carefully now. It's easy once you begin thinking in those terms. Our problem is, our challenge is, we don't think in those terms. But it's easy once you start thinking in those terms to find ways to do that. Where I live in Temple Terrace, Florida, every morning of the world, I go by, there's a Starbucks from my house, about 2 minutes from my house. I go by there every morning on the way to the office, every morning of the world. And I remember that Starbucks opened in July of 1999. I remember that date because as I was driving by and I saw the sign going up, I pulled off to the side of the road and offered a prayer of thanksgiving for that. And so, that particular Starbucks is like most of those stores. They go through managers a lot. They kind of turn them over quickly. But this Starbucks has had just countless managers. But they had one manager that was there for a good long while. Her name was Wendy. She was a very good manager. She ran a very good store. Her name was Wendy. She was from Chicago, the Windy City. And I am a Southern California boy by birth, but I graduated from high school outside of Chicago. I went my last 2 years of high school outside of Chicago. And so Wendy and I had a lot of common. We would talk about Chicago a lot. We both liked a lot of things about the city, and we would talk about that. Sunday mornings, I go in Starbucks very, very early on my way to the office, to the building. And Wendy liked to work on Sunday mornings because hardly anybody was in there. She could do her paperwork. She could get a lot done. So I'm in there on a Sunday morning, and it's just Wendy and me. And I said, Wendy, I said, look, I come and see you all the time where you work. When are you going to come see me where I work? And she said, oh, Don, she said, if I were to come into a church building, the building would just collapse. And I said, well, Wendy, we've got a strong building. I believe it could even handle you. She said, no, Don. She said, I don't think so. I said, okay, all right. So 2 or 3 weeks later, I was in again on Sunday morning, just the two of us again. And I said, hey, Wendy, listen, I'm serious now. I come and see you all the time where you work. I want you to come see me where I work. And she said, well, I'll think about it. Well, about 2 or 3 weeks later, in between Bible class and worship, I looked back, and Wendy was standing against the back wall of our auditorium. And so I went up to her, and I said, Wendy, I am so glad to see you. Welcome. We're so glad you're here. And she said, Don, she said, I know so many of these people. I said, yeah, we're all addicted to caffeine here, man. You know. I said, Wendy, come down here and sit with Vicky and me. She came down and sat with us. And in a week or two, I began to study the Bible with Wendy. We just sat across the table with an open Bible. And when Wendy began reading about a God, a Father, who could forgive her of everything. And I got to tell you, Wendy had a lot to be forgiven. She was living with a man to whom she was not married. She had lived a very difficult life, a very worldly life. But what became clear is that she wanted a better life. About 6 weeks later during the invitation, here comes Wendy. So she comes down the aisle. We're standing in the baptistry. And I'm trying to tell this story to the church in the baptistry. And I'm crying like a baby. And she's looking at me like, please, would you baptize me before something happens to me? Because this is not going to be good. You know? So I baptized Wendy. And about a year and a half later, I performed her wedding ceremony to a wonderful young Christian man. And all happened because I just found a way to offer an invitation in a way that wasn't off-putting, in a way that could resonate with it. We can all do that if we think about it, ladies and gentlemen. You see, we naturally talk about things that matter to us, things that we enjoy, right? I mean, coming in this building today, when you were in the foyer, you had conversations about things. Maybe you had a conversation about a football team that you followed yesterday. We don't have any trouble talking about that. You want to know what we have no trouble talking about at all? We have no trouble talking about our kids or our grandkids. We don't have any difficulty talking about with anybody about that at all. Because that matters to us. That's important to us. And so it's just natural to talk about that. Last year, I was pulling into that same Starbucks. A lot of my stories, by the way, have to do with coffee and Starbucks. But I was pulling into that same Starbucks. And there was something different that morning because there were two Chevy Tahoes. And the windows were completely blacked out. And they weren't parked in the spaces as they should be. They were parked horizontally. And so when I pulled in the space and got out, I noticed that outside of these two Chevy Tahoes, there were two individuals and they had on dark suits, and they had earpieces in, and they were standing outside. And when I went inside the Starbucks, standing off to the side of the line, there was another gentleman, and he had on a dark suit, and he had an earpiece, and he clearly had a weapon right here. And I thought, well, man, this coffee's expensive, but I didn't know he had to guard it like this. This is amazing, you know. But, now, I knew somebody important was in the Starbucks, but I didn't know who. So I get in line. And so I'm standing in line, and the gentleman in front of me turns around, and he sticks out his hand, and he says, my name is Rick Scott. What's yours? And I said, well, Governor, I know who you are. I voted for you. I said, I'm Don Truex. I said, it's really good to meet you today. And so we exchanged some pleasantries, and I said, well, Governor, what brings you to Tampa today? I said, Tampa's a long way from Tallahassee. And he said, oh, Don, he said, I'm dedicating a building over here at the campus of USF. He said, but let me tell you why I'm really glad to be here. He said, I'm really glad to be here because my daughter and her family all live here in Tampa. And today is my grandson's second birthday. And so I'm going to get to go to his birthday party today. And then he asked me that magic question. He said, do you have any grandchildren, Don? Yes, I do, Governor. Yes, I do, buddy. Right here they are. And so the governor takes out his phone and I take out my phone and we are showing each other pictures of our grandkids and we're having a conversation about our grandkids. Now, I'm going to tell you something. My grandkids are a lot better looking than the governor's. And but now here's the point of that. I did not have any trouble at all talking with the governor of the state of Florida about my grandchildren because those kids matter to me. I can talk to anybody about them. And see, we say, ladies and gentlemen, we say that the most important thing in our life is our relationship with God Almighty and His Son, Jesus Christ, and that His church matters to us, and that His Word is the compass for our life, and that our hope of heaven is our North Star that guides us from earth to heaven. We say that those things are the things that matter to us more than anything else in this world. If that's the truth, then we shouldn't have any difficulty talking about them. Problem is that we don't think about how to incorporate that into conversation. We try to help do that at home. In our congregation, one of our shepherds developed a little system that he calls gentle noise about how to casually introduce the concept of God and Jesus in conversations in a non-offensive, non-obtrusive kind of way, but really it's just a matter of thinking about that. Boy, we need to give God glory when we talk to people for the good things in our life. Sometimes you just need to tell somebody, look, I'm going to pray for you about that. And that opens a door. But everybody can speak if we just learn to think about it in those terms. Third, everybody can invite. Everybody can invite. I love this passage out of John 1. Philip found Nathanael, and he said, we have found him of whom Moses and the law and the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. Nathanael said, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? And Philip said to him, come and see. Now, I like that verse for two reasons. One, it always reminds me when he says, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? It always reminds me when I was at Florida College, we named the cafeteria Nazareth because nothing good ever came out of it. But secondly, I like the fact that he didn't argue with him. He didn't say, let me give you my 12 reasons why I think Jesus could be the Messiah. He just said, come and see. Just come and see for yourself. Would you just come and see? We all can do that. The easiest thing you will ever do in evangelism, ladies and gentlemen, is invite others to come and see. I mean, you know, you can invite your friends to come to this building, not be embarrassed. Nobody's going to shy away from the truth here. Nobody's ever going to skirt difficult issues and hard questions. But by the same token, you and I both know that your preachers at this place will speak the truth in love. Jesus' last words were, go into all the world and preach the gospel. I think we listen to that and we let ourselves off the hook and say, I can't go to all the world. But really he's saying, go to your world. Go wherever it is that you do life. Go into your school, your workplace, your rec center. Go to your next door neighbor, wherever it is. Go where you do life. And the easiest thing you'll ever do is say, how about coming to worship with me? Come and see. Now, when you do that, what's the worst that could happen? I mean, the worst thing that could happen is that they might say, nah, thanks, but no thanks. Would that be so soul-shattering that can we not handle that? The easiest thing you'll ever do is just say, come and see. And then fourth, and I want to say just a word about this. This is when people come to our assembly. We need to welcome them. We need to welcome them. We hardly ever think about this. But would you think about this with me for just a moment this morning? Let's think about it this way. In James chapter 2, we're not going to take the time to read that. So let me give you just the Reader's Digest version of that. And James 2 says, look, if they're coming to your assembly and there's a gentleman, he's extremely well-dressed, and you're kind of impressed by that, you say, look, we've got a place of prominence and honor for you right down here in the front. But there also comes into your assembly a poor man. He's not dressed very well, and clearly he's not affluent. And you say to him, we're going to put you over here out of sight and out of mind. Now, the main lesson that James is teaching is that you become a respecter of persons and a judge about that. And he says, don't do that. Don't do that. But have you ever thought about the fact that one of the lessons that is at least implied in that is that we will have visitors to our assembly? James just assumes that we're going to have visitors in our assembly. Okay, how are we going to get them? How are they going to come in? Why are they going to come? Well, some may come because they're Christians, and they're, but we're talking about non-Christians here. How are we going to have non-Christian visitors to our assembly? The only way is if we invite them to come and see. Because, ladies and gentlemen, people are not going to wander in this building this morning from Clovis. We'd like for them to. But look, they're sleeping, they're reading the paper, they're playing golf, they're watching football. They're doing everything in the world except what we would like for them to be doing this morning, which is be here. So the only way they're going to come here is if we invite. But James then implies that when we invite individuals and they come, that how we treat them is going to have an impact on them. In fact, every survey in the world indicates that non-Christian visitors to an assembly decide within the first 2, 3, 4 minutes whether they will ever come back. And so we've got to welcome them. We've got to make sure they know that they're welcome. You know, we're comfortable here this morning. I'm from 3,000 miles away, but I come into the assembly this morning and I'm completely comfortable. Now, I may not know the exact order that you're going to do things this morning, but I know what you're going to do, and I know what it all means. But a non-Christian visitor to our assembly, that's like putting somebody on stage of a play before the curtain opens, and they have no idea what's going to happen because they're not a part of it. And the curtain opens, and everybody begins saying their lines and moving on cue because they know what's going on, and they're standing there lost. That's a non-Christian visitor to our assemblies on a Sunday morning. And so we've got to make sure that when you see somebody you don't recognize, you introduce yourself. Now, I said that, by the way, in a church, and a lady came to me afterwards, and she said, you know what, Don, I did that. I went up to a lady I didn't recognize. I introduced myself, and she said, well, I've been a member of this church for 3 years. And I said, that's great. You met somebody you should have met 3 years ago. Come on. You see somebody you don't know, introduce yourself. If they're a visitor, invite them to come and sit with you. If they've got kids, take them to a young family that has kids. Introduce them. Have them sit with them. Make them welcome. Think about if you were in that situation. Look, ladies and gentlemen, I said at the beginning that I'm not much into drive-by guiltings, and I'm not. I'm not going to say to you, look, 6,500 people die every hour. Now, that's true, by the way. That means 155,000 people die every day. That's true also, by the way. Most of those people are going to die lost. Well, that's unfortunately true as well. And it's your fault. No, I'm not going to tell you that. I'm not going to tell you that. It's their fault. They made life choices, and they'll have to pay the consequences for that. But I tell you what is our responsibility. Our responsibility is to introduce as many individuals as we can to the Son of God. Now, what they do with him after we make the introduction is up to them. But that's our task. Have you ever thought about this, ladies and gentlemen? The Apostle Paul would say in the first century that the gospel had gone to the habitable world. Isn't that amazing? How in the world did that happen? I mean, the gospel went to the entire world without a single billboard, no correspondence courses, no website, no Facebook, no Twitter, no Instagram, no television, no text messaging, no CDs, no DVDs, no bulletins, no flyers, no Bible class material. How did it happen? It happened because one hungry person told another hungry person where the bread line was. It happened when one individual who read the book and liked the book and liked the author of the book introduced the book and the author to someone else, which is exactly the same way that it will have to happen today. Thank you all very much for your attention.